This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In April 2015, Archbishop Desmond Tutu traveled to the Dalai Lama's home in India to celebrate His Holiness's 80th birthday and to create what they hoped would be a gift for others. They looked back on their long lives to answer a single question: how do we find joy in the face of life's inevitable suffering? Author Doug Abrams was there with the two Nobel Peace Prize laureates and shares many of their insights, experiences, and beliefs in his latest offering, The Book of Joy: Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. I recently spoke with Doug Abrams about how these men have remained joyful in the face of adversity and how we can find joy in our own lives. Doug, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's great to be here, Mark.
Set the stage for us. How did the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Tutu end up in this get-together, and how did you get involved in it?
Well, it actually goes back quite a few years now. When the Archbishop was turning 80, the Dalai Lama was supposed to be the guest of honor at the birthday party in South Africa, and because of pressure from China, South Africa didn't give him a visa. So when the Dalai Lama was turning 80, we knew we wanted to get these two famous friends who call each other mischievous spiritual brother together. And we were actually at Archbishop Tutu's wife's birthday party when the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation turned to me and said, "What do you think about the idea of the two of them doing a book together?" And I said, "Wow, that sounds amazing. What would the book be about?" And then we turned to each other and we said, "Joy." Because here are two of the most extraordinarily joyous people on the planet. So we were having sandwiches with Archbishop Tutu, and who often is called Arch, and I turned to him and said, "Arch, would you like to do a book with the Dalai Lama?" And he said, "I'd do anything with that man."
That's amazing. I mean, you had to be sitting there thinking, this is a rare occasion. I mean, how often do two iconic people like this have the opportunity to even get together?
Yeah, it's amazing. Global leaders like the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu don't typically get time to hang out with their buddies, and to have a whole week together in Dharamsala at the Dalai Lama's home in exile was pretty extraordinary and pretty unique. And we knew this was going to be a historic meeting, you know, the first time they'd ever had this amount of time together, and perhaps the last time they would be together. But what we didn't realize was how incredible it would be for the two of them, how much it would mean for them. And when the Archbishop got off the plane and, you know, they were embracing, and, you know, Archbishop Tutu was holding the Dalai Lama's face, you know, kind of like a grandfather holding his precious one, you know, and the Dalai Lama pretended to blow a kiss to the Archbishop, and the Archbishop went in for a kiss. Probably the first kiss the Dalai Lama's had, and since he was taken from his family at the age of two and became the Dalai Lama, and they both cackled with laughter. I mean, it was just it was magical to watch.
Well, tell us some more about this get together. What were some of the highlights?
Well, there were many. So we spent a week in deep dialogue talking about the true nature of joy, and the book is kind of the chronicle of that, those dialogues. We gathered questions from over 1,000 people around the world, and I worked with the Dalai Lama's translator, Jimpa, distill those questions and ask those questions. So we had these amazing times of just exploration of the nature of true joy, the nature of happiness, the obstacles to joy, the pillars of joy. We explored all of those. But we also got these amazing times together where we could break bread and talk, and they'd laugh. And, you know, the first lunch, the Dalai Lama was going on and telling a story and kind of interrupting the Archbishop. And, you know, he was saying, and the Archbishop said, "You know, yeah, I'm talking now," you know, jokingly. And, you know, the Dalai Lama was teasing him. They were teasing back and forth. And Archbishop Tutu said, "You know, act like a holy man." You know, so I mean, they were so funny. They were almost like as much of a comedy team as they were these two sacred, venerated leaders. Another amazing moment was we threw a birthday party for the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama danced for the first time in his life. And it was, as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, he was prohibited from dancing. It was this amazing moment at this school that the Dalai Lama has for children who are not able to get a Tibetan education in Tibet, and their parents send them away as early as the age of five over the mountain passes with guides or family members, and they come to this school not knowing if they're going to see their families for 13 years, if ever. And these kids were sharing these incredibly moving stories of their leaving their families and breaking down in tears. And then at the end of this, the band of the school played, and it was this incredibly joyous moment. And the Archbishop had said that these kids would someday be dancing with their families in the streets of Tibet. And the Dalai Lama was, you know, kind of sitting there as Archbishop Tutu, being African, was getting up and doing kind of his all elbows boogie. And finally, he was kind of, you know, he starts encouraging the Dalai Lama to get up and dance. And the Dalai Lama gets up and, you know, he does a little shuffle. He does a little shimmy, a little jazz hands. You know, he was about as comfortable as a junior high school boy at his first dance. But to see him get to boogie for the first time was pretty amazing.
I bet it was. Now, you were talking about how these are two of the most joyous people in the world. And both these men have faced a lot of hardships. They've witnessed a lot of horrible things in their life. How is it that they're able to be such joyous people?
It's a wonderful question, and it was really what we were after in writing the Book of Joy, because the book is really about how do we experience joy in the face of adversity and suffering. It's not, you know, don't worry, be happy. It's about two of the most extraordinary people who have faced all of this personal and communal hardship and suffering, and really looked straight on at the suffering of our world and still been able to find joy. There were a number of things. I mean, there were there were the pillars of joy that they shared, which we can talk about, which really allow one to have joy even in the face of that suffering. And there are the ways that we overcome the obstacles of joy that they talked a lot about. But I'd say one of the biggest pieces of it was the ability to have perspective, which is the first pillar of joy, which is a reframing. And this is actually, we went to the scientists as well, and they said that this is one of the key components of happiness, is the ability to reframe negative experiences into a more positive experience. What Archbishop Tutu says, to find meaning in one's suffering. And, you know, when the very beginning of the dialogue, Archbishop Tutu turned to the Dalai Lama when he was talking about his exile, and he said, "Why are you not morose?" The Dalai Lama didn't know what the term morose was, so he was kind of trying to get the clarification from his translator, and the Archbishop said, "Sad. Why are you not sad? Here you are. You've been turfed out of your country. One of the greatest losses anyone can experience is to lose one's country, one's people. And here you are. You're this incredibly joyous, ebullient person with equanimity." And the Dalai Lama said, "You know, I've actually found my exile to be enormously enriching. You know, I have gotten closer to life than I would ever have been in my gilded cage in Lhasa, Tibet," which is just, our jaws dropped.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the suffering that he had experienced or that his people had experienced, but even in that enormous suffering, he was able to see the ways that had enriched him. And he said, "You know, and I probably would never have met you," you know, to the Archbishop. And it was that ability to reframe, and as the Archbishop said, to find, you know, to take, our suffering can either be ennobling or it can be embittering. And the difference is our ability to find meaning and purpose and to use that suffering for our benefit and the benefit of others.
I think it's important, too, Doug, to make a distinction between joy as an emotion and joy as a state of being, because that's what you're really talking about, is joy as a state of being.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's a really important distinction, and one that was also central to the dialogues, which was, we were really interested in how do you take joy, which so often feels like this fleeting emotional state, and how do you make it into an enduring character trait? I mean, what these two amazing men have is joy as a character trait. It's a way of being in the world. It's not a kind of ephemeral emotional state that kind of flitters like a butterfly landing on your shoulder and leaving. And one of the major distinctions of how to do that that they talked about was the difference between kind of physical happiness and mental happiness, or physical joy and mental joy. This is something that the Dalai Lama spoke very powerfully about, which is that, you know, when physical happiness is great, it's wonderful, it's so fundamental to being human. You know, it's when we have a good meal or we're listening to good music. And, you know, the Dalai Lama, despite, you know, the goal of Buddhist detachment, clearly seemed to be enjoying his food. He turned to me at one point during while we were sitting next to each other at lunch, and he showed me the kind of Tibetan bowl of rice pudding, and that is a kind of a dessert there, a kind of traditional monastic dessert. And he said, "I love this," you know. I loved that he loved it. You know, here is this kind of paragon of spiritual enlightenment and detachment, and still he loves his rice pudding. So there's nothing wrong with that kind of joy and that kind of happiness. But at the same time, what they were clear about and what he explained was that it's really this mental happiness, deeper character happiness, this true nature of joy that is much more enduring. It lasts much longer. It's not so ephemeral. Even when the Tibetan rice pudding is over, you still have it. Kind of, and one of the pillars of that longer enduring happiness is actually compassion, which was fascinating to hear. And he said, when you do a meditation on compassion, you have happiness for 24 hours. He said, even before coffee? He said, yes, even before coffee. So that was one of the eight pillars that they talked about of joy.
So reframing, compassion. What are the other six pillars?
There are four pillars of the mind and four pillars of the heart. So the first one is perspective. The second one is humility. The third one is humor and the ability to laugh at ourselves and our lives. The fourth is acceptance, which they were very clear doesn't mean acquiescence. The chapter on acceptance is called Acceptance, the Only Place from Where Change Can Occur. But it's an acceptance of the reality of what is. And then the four pillars of the heart that grow out of those four pillars of the mind are forgiveness, gratitude, compassion, and generosity.
Is there a scientific side? Is there a science behind all this, Doug?
Well, it is fascinating because when I met with the Dalai Lama before we went to Dharamsala, he was adamant that this could not be a Buddhist book, it should not be a Christian book, it needed to be a universal human book. And he, as many know, is a big believer in science, as is the Archbishop, and the importance of what the Archbishop calls self-corroborating truth, when many different disciplines point to the same reality. And so they asked me to bring the scientists and the science to bear on what they had to say. And I've had the privilege of working with many of the leading researchers in what you could call happiness science or the science of well-being. And so we brought a lot of the neuroscience, a lot of the science from many different disciplines, which was really interesting. And one example was they were talking about how important it is for us. I mean, one of the core insights of this book was the interrelationship between joy and sorrow. And that, I think when I went into the book and this process, I kind of thought, my goal is to stay as far away from sorrow and to stay as much in joy as possible, to be in happiness and away from any of the seemingly negative states of emotion. And what you did, what they were adamant about is that actually it's through that sorrow that we often experience our greatest joy. And, the Archbishop said it's kind of like when you're lifting weights and you to build a strong muscle, that they're similarly in our character and in our soul, there's something where opposition, adversity, resistance seems to develop our capacity both for joy and for, and our character in general. And, he pointed to the Dalai Lama and said, as an example, that he was saying that it wasn't despite the adversity that he was such the joyful person he was, but actually because of what he had experienced. And so we went to, you know, it was fascinating to hear from a perinatal epidemiologist, you know, a kind of OBGYN researcher, that the fundamental cells of our embryo do not differentiate, do not divide, unless we have there's enough what's called biological stress in our environment. So fundamentally, at the core of our human development, we don't actually become who we are without that biological stress, without enough of that opposition. So it's a fascinating example, both biologically or metaphorically, how we really kind of baked into our experience of being human is the necessity of this overcoming of adversity, stress, and suffering in our experience of becoming human and developing as human beings.
Yeah, and speaking of adversity and stress, we are living in a time of such great unease. What are some practices that people can use to help them cope?
Well, it's a good question, and I think there is so much suffering in our country and in our world, and their example is a couple. I mean, there are a couple things that I think they would say. I think the pillars of joy are essential. Having perspective, not getting overly fixated on the kind of news headlines of the day, but recognizing, as they both said, that we are in this great arc of history, and that that moral arc, as Martin Luther King Jr. famously said, this arc of history bends towards justice. So recognizing that we actually, life for human beings on the planet is getting better. I mean, it was fascinating to just one small example. Historically, 1,000 years ago, people had a 1 in 4 chance of dying at the hands of another human. You know, that's now 1 in 100,000. So when we look at the violence in our world and the terrorist attacks, it makes us so upset and horrified, recognizing that there is progress that we are a part of and that we can be a part of. That's, I think, a fundamental piece of it. Another part of it, I think, that they would say is the ability to find ways to positively engage and make a difference. You know, that, you know, if we can turn that suffering or that pain into some place where we feel like we're contributing and we're making a difference and we're not just victims of circumstance and of history, but we're actually playing a role in making life better, I think, and that we can transform and transmute that suffering into something that is beneficial locally, nationally, internationally for others. I think that's fundamentally essential. And then a third thing I would say that the Archbishop has said so beautifully, he said, we have to be like dishwashers, not vacuum cleaners for suffering. So when we face that suffering, we can't just suck it all in and kind of hold on to it. We have to use the kind of joy practices that they give in the Book of Joy, the kind of meditative practices, to be able to transform that suffering and let go of that suffering and pass along that suffering so that it doesn't just build up and cause us to get ulcers and despair, that we pass it back on and are able to kind of almost titrate the dosage of, you know, how many Twitter feeds we're watching and how much news and how we process that in our life. And, you know, the more we process it, the more that we can really face that suffering without turning away and ignoring it.
Yeah, good analogy, though. Be a dishwasher, not a vacuum cleaner.
Exactly.
After getting to see both of these men together, just such a rare, remarkable event, how do you top that?
That's a good question. You know, it's, I mean, I think the thing that you realize in the face of just extraordinary humanity, like you witnessed with the two of them, is how human they are. And one of the things that was really profoundly important that they wanted to do in the book was not just to be on the mountaintop preaching, but to really share their stories and their humanity. And the book, you know, kind of has these three parts to it. It has that travelogue experience of being there with them in Dharamsala. It has their teachings and their stories of their humanity, and it has the science. So you have these dimensions of it where you actually really get to see them in a way that is so rare, because we don't usually get to see the inside view of a great moral leader's own struggles and own humanity. And I think it reminds us of the greatness and the potential for greatness of all of us. And so whether it's being with my other extraordinary clients or being with my wife or being with my kids or my friends, you realize that it's all just the joy of human relationship. And whether you're with Nobel laureates or you're with your child, you know, at the dinner table, that's our greatest joy, that kind of relationship.
Doug, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's such a pleasure, Mark. Great to be with you.
Doug Abrams, author of The Book of Joy, Lasting Happiness in a Changing World. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.